Hi everybody, I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic. I'm visiting from the Primary Purpose Group in Austin, Texas. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and that's the most important thing that's ever happened in my life. I'm honored to be asked. I want to thank Stephanie and the legend of Mickey and Colleen. I've still never met them, but I want to thank anybody that had anything to do with me being here. It's always an honor to be asked to speak at an AA meeting. And it's funny, you know, they said to wear a tie, and I always wear a coat and tie when I'm behind, or at least when I start off, I wear a coat and tie from behind the podium, and out of respect for AA and our history and stuff. But I mean, the bulk of my history and bulk of my experience in a coat and tie, usually when I put it, most of my memory, when I put on a coat and tie, my job was to stand there and say, "No contest, Your Honor." I mean, that's just my experience, you know. I mean, that's what I'm hoping to talk about tonight. I never know what I'm going to talk about. But I hope to get around to just describe a little bit to you about the love affair I have with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to qualify. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I come from a really normal family. I mean, I know normal is a setting on a washing machine, but I've heard enough fifth steps to know that a lot of people had it a lot worse than I had it. I mean, I don't blame my alcoholism on the way I grew up. I don't blame my alcoholism on any outside circumstances. But I grew up, you know, during the baby boom in a pretty regular household. And my sister, can y'all hear me okay? Yeah. My sister was perfect. I don't know about it, if anybody else experienced that. And my mother was a first grade school teacher. And so 42 years my mother was a first grade school teacher. So I was really well prepared for the first grade. I kind of kicked ass, you know. I mean, all the way up to like, you know, fifth grade, I held it together pretty good, you know. But I grew up. I don't know if anybody else grew up under the burden of potential, but my whole life I was told about, you know, why don't you live up to your potential? Why can't you be more like Charles Malir across the street? And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, I'm really not holding back that much, you know. I mean, but I went along, and, you know, I didn't take my first drink of alcohol until I was 16 years old. And, you know, I sobered up in 85, and I used to think 16 was kind of young to get started drinking, you know, and nowadays it's not even young to stop, you know. I mean, it's like, I don't know about in Phoenix, but it seems like in Texas, you know, people are picking up Desire chips at like 8, you know. I mean, you know, you're like, oh, are you looking for your parents? And they're, no, I'm here for a 90-day chip, you know. And it's like, Welcome. You know, and I ain't busting on anybody. Much love for the young people in AA. I mean, I started drinking when I was 16, and I didn't really need this program until I was probably 17. But I didn't come in when I was 17. And, you know, and I rocked along. You know, I talk about being an alcoholic, and our book says, I'm a little bit of a big book thumper. I'm an unapologetic big book thumper, and I'll probably get to that later about the way that came about, but I might as well tell you now. Not that part, but during my talk, I will say, I'll get to that later. You know, I'll say something, and I go, oh, what? But I'll get to that later. What that means, all that means is that this is an inappropriate time in the talk to talk about that piece. But when I say I'm going to get back to it later, I'm not coming back to it. My brain is like Grand Central Station, you know, and every thought that comes into it, I got to take for a ride, you know. But I'll do my best, you know, but sometimes when I say I'm going to get back to it, there's about a 10% shot, you know. But, you know, our book says the first requirement is that we fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. And in order for that to take place, I mean, there's a lot said in that statement. First of all, I got to know what it means to be an alcoholic. And second, there's a big difference. The longest journey you'll ever take in recovery is from up here to right here. And fully conceding to my innermost self is a lot different from when I first came into the program and said, well, yeah, I must be alcoholic. I mean, I drink every day. All the people I know drink every day. I've had a lot of trouble as a result of drinking. That I will get to later. But, you know, what it means when I say I'm an alcoholic, and what the way it's beautifully described in the first 53 pages of this book, is that I have a body that reacts funny to alcohol. When I drink, it ain't regular. There's something that happens inside of me that only happens in about 10% of the population. There's only about 10% of the people that even have the potential to become alcoholics. And what it means is that when I take a drink, it triggers a craving inside of me that I got no control over. And I can't tell you, if I took a drink standing up here tonight, I couldn't tell you how long I'm going to drink, when I'm going to stop, or what's going to happen with any predictability. Not my worst problem, though. I mean, because I always say, if my biggest problem was my reaction to alcohol, detox centers would turn out winners. You with me? I mean, if my biggest problem was alcohol, I would only had to stop drinking one time. My problem is that I've always been sober when I make that decision to take the first drink. So the craziest thing that ever happens in my life happens when I'm stone cold sober. So that's it. You know, that's the, if you don't get anything else out of my talk and you're new tonight, get that what it means to be alcoholic doesn't mean that he got a DWI. It doesn't mean I've been to jail, she left, I lost the house, lost the car, lost the job, all that stuff. What it means is that I've got a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And it's those two things working together because that make me an alcoholic. You know, one is that I can't drink regular, and the other is that I got a mind that's always going to make me drink. That's the shortest version I can tell of what's so beautifully put forth in this book, is that I get stuck. Once I lost the choice of power, the power of choice and control, I was stuck in a cycle where I was going to drink until I had to stop. And then I would stop until I had to drink. And if that makes sense to you, that's really bad news. You know, because you know, there's no good news in step one. I mean, you know, if I sit down with a new guy, you know, and I spend an hour or so describing step one, and if he's not scared and depressed, he's either not alcoholic or he's psychotic and we can't help him, you know? I mean, but because this would really be an awful program. But they say doctors don't like to tell us the nature of our disease. They definitely didn't like to back in the 30s because they didn't have a solution until these guys came along that wrote this book. But we got a solution. So, because this would really be a crappy program if I got up here and said, okay, for you new guys, here's the deal. You got a body that doesn't react regular to alcohol. It's, you know, it's never going to be predictable. It's always going to get worse. It's never going to get better. But that's not the worst part. The worst part is your brain is going to always convince you that's a good idea to have a drink. Really sorry. You know, I mean, try to have a nice day. You know, but that's what it means, you know, when it says fully conceived our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. You know, when the doctor's opinion, when he says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, that one always makes me giggle a little bit because, I mean, can you tell that the doctor was not an alcoholic? He loved us. He helped a lot of us. But if one of us had written that, don't you think we'd have said something with a little more oomph than like the effect produced by alcohol? You know, I mean, I like banana pudding. You know, I mean, I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, and so, I mean, for most of us, and for myself included, the first time I took a drink of alcohol was a very, very big day in my life. I mean, I remember thinking, oh, we're going to do this a lot. You know, I mean, because You know, we use a lot of unfamiliar terms in Alcoholics Anonymous. We use a lot of, I don't know, for you new guys who know exactly, I don't ever want to forget what it's like to be new in this program. Everybody in this room, whether it's somebody with 40 years or 40 hours, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has had day one. We all know what it's like to come in scared to death, completely powerless, and not know how to get through one day without taking a drink. You know, it's not like some of us came in on an accelerated program or something. You know, I mean, it's. I don't ever want to forget what that feels like. But when we come in, there's a. Did anybody else feel like they were speaking a foreign language when you come in here? You know, it's like Mr. Bill and Dr. Bob, and this doctor's got an opinion, and this doctor's got a nightmare, and you know, I mean. What the hell? And, you know, if you're having trouble with your four, go back to your three because it could be your one. And when you get up to eight and nine, you're going to need a strong one. And, you know, but one of the terms they talk about, and they don't talk about it until you get up to about page 63 in the book, 62, I think, where they talk about a spiritual malady. That term always had a lot of trouble wrapping my brain around. But I had a black hole inside of me from as far back as I can remember. It went back easily to elementary school. I had a hole inside of me that made me feel separate from everybody else, made me feel less than, made me feel different, made me feel like I had to outperform you to feel in any way equal to you. And I just never really felt like I was a part of it. Most people in AA know what that's like. You know, I mean, that term, to me, that's the spiritual malady, and that's what's driving that mental obsession that drives me back to drinking, triggering that phenomenon of craving, creating all that havoc in my life over and over again. There was a time when my drinking worked really well, and it was going really good, and then, like most of us, I started losing the power of choice and control. And, you know, I'm going to try to speed through the drinking part of my story, but it started off real fun and with very little bad effect. Then I started having bad effects. Then I started having a lot of bad effects and a little fun. And then, you know, trying to recreate the way it had been for me when I was 17, 18, 19 years old. You know, little stuff like left a bar in a blackout one night came out of a blackout after an impact, and the fender was sticking up at an odd angle. And short version of the story is I grabbed my shoes and I went running back to the bar, and I saw cops out there looking at this car that I'd run into. I'm running under the trees to get back to the bar so I can report the car stolen. But as I'm driving past, two cops are there with a flashlight, and there's glass all on the ground, and I remember thinking, my God, they got here fast. And I'm running with my sneakers in my hand, and so the next day they said, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to take a polygraph test before you can pick your car up. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, you've got to be kidding. And he says, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast, you know? Because I've been a little foggy on that one. You know, but we talk about our lives being saved and changed by seconds and inches. And, you know, if those two cops had been standing there, you'd probably have a different speaker tonight. You know, and I had a lot of breaks like that. You know, the stuff went poorly in some situations, but it could have gone a hell of a lot worse. You know, as it started to unravel for me, I like to say it started getting a little sloppy. You know, I mean, it got to where people didn't want to see me around, I started getting charges while you still got pending charges, you know, and it starts really looking sloppy on paper. And, you know, what happened, but I like to tell one story when I talk about the loss of choice and control. I was very, very fond of pawn shops. I loved pawn shops. It's such a pure equation, you know. I mean, you walk in there and you hand them the deer rifle, and they give you the money, and you walk out. You know, I've never had a pawnbroker go, Jesus, Charlie, what are you going to do with this money? You know, or, weren't you just in here this morning? You know, it's always in and out. You know, and there's the weak part of that deal is that I didn't own a lot of stuff. So I was forced to pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. And that creates hard feelings. But I had a plan, you know. I mean, I was a smart guy, you know, and you had like 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop. And so I would try to pull a scam every 90 days. And you know what, but talk about things starting to go badly. I remember one time I came out of a five-day blackout. I don't remember a thing from a five-day period. And I'd pulled a scam that was going to get everything out of the pawn shop. And when I came out of this blackout, I was at my mother's house. I should tell you that I was so poorly treated as a child that I finally ran away from home for good at the age of 28. And I mean, it never went back. And, but I came out of this blackout sitting on the edge of the bed at my mother's house, and I had $8 in my pocket. And I had this gangster wad of pawn tickets, you know. I mean, I hadn't gotten a damn thing out of the pawn shop. And I just remember going, oh, no, you know. Because I'd shot my wad getting the money that was supposed to get it out. And I got nothing, you know. I mean, I got either. And so I had to go to my father. And my dad was a good man. He worked hard for the stuff. Nobody was giving him his stuff. And I'd have to go to my dad and go, Dad, if we act now, I can get you a really good deal on all of your stuff. You know? But if we wait till tomorrow, it's all retail, you know. And I should also tell you, I'm a big guy. You know, I ride Harleys, all that stuff. I'm also likely to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here at the podium. And this story hits me hard sometimes. So I have to kind of tell it like it's a joke, or I'll just start blubbering up here. Because what I'd have to do was get in the car with my dad, and this was in Dallas, Texas. Dallas is a big town like Phoenix, you know. So, I mean, it wasn't we're just going to go to the pawn shop. It was we got to go over to Buckner Boulevard and get your deer rifle. Then we got to go out to Harry Hines and get the metal detector. And then I left a shotgun over in Oak Cliff, and then we need to go over on Harry Hines to get the sterling silver. And it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And the most important thing about that story is that when we were riding along, I would say, Dad, I am so sorry, you know. As we're riding along, I would go, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. And if I was lying to that guy, I didn't know it, because I meant it with every fiber of my being. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about the loss of choice and control. I wasn't getting loaded because I liked to party anymore. I couldn't not get loaded, because when I would swear to my dad that I wasn't going to do it anymore, I would hit his house like a cat burglar within 48 hours of that day, you know, and I'd be in the back door to his house, and he'd just be like, that, and off we go to the pawn shop, you know, and the short version of the story, if that's possible at this point, is me and my dad made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times before I got sober, and that whole time I was fixing to go to treatment, you know, I was about to go to treatment for 9 months. And so I know what it's like to be kind of wanting to sort of maybe think about starting to quit, you know. And you know, because next week is a good time to go to treatment, you know. I mean, when you think about it, and sometimes when it'd get really bad, by God, I'm going to go tomorrow, you know. I mean, well, probably tomorrow afternoon. But you know, and then, but it had been a long time since I'd been cool, you know. I always like to tell a story. I was out at this treatment center that I do a lot of work at. And this guy was there, and he was getting discharged like the next day, you know, and just as full of crap as a Christmas turkey, and you know, and just get, and they're getting ready to put him on the street, you know, and we're talking. He goes, you know, man. He says they're telling me I got to do this and I got to do that, but you know, I ain't gonna do it. I'm kind of slick, man, so I ain't gonna do it like that. And I got my own ideas. And I said, hold up, pal, hold up, just a second, you know. I said, look, when you call me from Manhattan, and you're up in a penthouse. And you're partying with Donald Trump and Puff Daddy or whatever he calls himself this month, you know, and you got the New York Giants cheerleaders up there with you and stuff, you know. We'll talk about how slick you are, you know, but when you check yourself into the Austin Recovery Center, you kind of cash in all your slick chips, you know. I mean, it's like, you know. But that's it, you know. I mean, that's, you know, when it talks about that, I don't really... My alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. I had no idea how far down the scale I'd gone. Because everybody I knew drank like I did. My mother would say, you drink every day. And I'd think, well, yeah. You know, I mean, everybody I know drinks every day. Why wouldn't you drink every day? You know, I mean, but if you're like me... People want to talk to you about your drinking. You know, when you drink like I do, people always want to talk to you about your drinking. The most important thing that happens in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, though, from the first day in 1934 up to today, the most important thing that takes place in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's one alcoholic talking to another one. That's the way our program started. That's the way it works best today. Because in my book, it says, for a message to interest and hold an alcoholic, it's got to have depth and weight. And what they're meaning is, don't come at me with some half-baked, half-assed, you know, understanding of what we do and why we do it. Because people would always want to talk to me about my drinking that didn't understand what it did for me. I mean, because I would sit there, and I know about that black hole I got in there. And I'm thinking, okay, I understand. And from where you're sitting... It probably looks like, you know, I drink too much. And sometimes I overshoot the mark a little bit, you know, and I wreck the car, I lose the job, or I lose the house, or she moves out, or whatever. But if you understood what that does for me inside, you wouldn't be coming at me with silly crap like, you need to stop drinking, you know? AA was the first place I'd ever been where I was around people that had drank like I had, that knew how to, that had stopped and seemed happy about it. And, you know, they had a solution. Well, fast forward a few years. I skipped over a lot of stuff I usually talk about, but hopefully by now you figured out that I was a... I should say, I just, one other thing about my drinking. From that time when I was 16 years old, it would be real macho to stand up here and say that I drank whiskey and did outside substances every day until the day that I sobered up. But that wouldn't necessarily be true. But what is the absolute truth that I can promise you with everything I got is that from that day at 16 years old until the day I sobered up in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances for any reason. There was never one time where you would hold something out and I'd go, oh, no, you see, it's my mother's birthday, and you know, I have to be somewhere in February, or, you know, or, you know, something like, you know, it was just all bets are off. I was completely powerless over not doing anything. Well, I like to talk a little bit about what happened when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've been in the program 22 years. I've had a lot of that time. In fact, I was in it for 10 and a half months before that. I had a relapse at 10 and a half months, and then I sobered up on March 22nd of 84, and my sobriety date is now March 22nd of 85. It's been March 22nd two different times. Well, somebody asked me one time, they said, did you do that on purpose? And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah. I had that kind of manageability, you know. Like, wow, I'm gonna wait till Friday to stop, you know, and that'll be really cool, you know. No, I just looked up one day, and I had 3 days sober, and it was the same day. It was March 22nd of the following year. But I've had different kinds of experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm trying to leave myself a little bit of time to talk about that, because, you know, what happens in this... Thanks, Beth. Katie's here with me. Were any of y'all here when Katie talked a couple of months ago? She just picked up 23 years last Sunday. She's got 4.5 months on, man. She'll never let me live it down. You know, I've kept her sober a time or two, though, by telling her if she drank, I'd sponsor her when she came back. You know, that's not going to happen. But she and I were litter mates, you know, and we came in together, and there was a whole bunch of us, you know, and we were having a good time and sober. And I don't like to get up and talk about, you know, we're doing it right now and anybody else is doing it wrong, or that my sponsor was doing anything wrong, you know, because, or anything like that. But I've had different levels of experience in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had different levels of spiritual awakenings as a result of this program. But I think what happened for me the first time when I came in, and I'd been in AA for a while, I mean, the reason I like to talk so much about what it really means to be an alcoholic is that physical allergy coupled with the mental obsession, because what's driving all that is a spiritual malady. And the problem with that is that when you take away alcohol from me, I don't get okay. You know, I mean, has anybody else experienced that? You know, the book says we're restless, irritable, and discontented until we can again experience the ease and comfort which we get from taking a couple of drinks. I mean, restless, I don't have to tell you about. You know, irritable is that, you know, when Katie says, "Good morning, honey," and I go, "Oh, are you jacking with me already this morning?" It's going to be like that, huh? You know, and discontented. That was an exaggeration for the crowd there, okay? And discontented is when I start not liking the deal I'm getting, you know? And that takes place well into sobriety. That, you know, we have a lot of these meetings where we talk about traffic and work and people and stuff, and what we're talking about is untreated alcoholism, you know, because I think what happened for me, the first period that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I really thought my problem was alcohol, you know, and there was a part of me that thought that if I stayed dry, that was it, you know, and they would say half measures availed us nothing, and I'm thinking, half measures avail us nothing, my ass. You know, it's gone pretty good for me. I mean, you know, I'm half measuring it. But what I was doing was I was going to a bunch of AA meetings. You know, this triangle right here that's about 4 inches behind me is a three-sided triangle. And what I was doing was I was doing the work of one side of the triangle, but I was expecting the benefits of all three sides. You know, used to in our book, it would say unity, service, and recovery on the three sides. It really pissed me off that they took it out in 1993, because it used to be right there with the book. And what my sponsor does now a lot of times, Mark H. is my sponsor, and when I check in with him, he'll go, "Where you at with the circle and triangle?" You know, and the unity is the fellowship of the people in the program. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm doing a lot of meetings. I'm going out to the ranch on Mondays and talking to the guys. We got the primary purpose group on Tuesday night. Doing plenty of fellowship. What about service? Well, I'm sponsoring 14 guys, and I'm doing the Monday thing, and then we're doing the meeting at the house, and doing all this stuff, and so I'm pretty involved in the service work. And I say, if I'm weak on anything, it'd be in the recovery program right now, because in the past 7 days, I've probably done 5 morning meditations and maybe 3 evening reviews, you know, and that's the way we check in, you know, and in a matter of minutes, he can get an idea where I'm at with the program. But what I was doing that first time was all this side right here. It was all unity, and the one thing I want to really be sure is that you don't hear me up here saying that I don't like the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Katie and I go to a lot of conferences, we go to a lot of meetings and stuff like that. But going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous does not treat alcoholism. It's bad news, you know. But what happens is, what happened for me was, I think I had this understanding that, you know how you hear guys going, well, kicked the dog this morning on my way out the door and screamed at my wife, and I left work 2 hours early and did 3 hours of internet porn and did some gambling on the way home, and but I didn't drink today, and that makes me a winner, you know? And you're like, no, that kind of makes you an asshole, you know? You know, but that was what my understanding was, because I had a program that was based on abstinence from alcohol. And the reason I like to talk about it is because when I live a life that's based on abstinence from alcohol, then the only thing, you know, that I'm going to get is dry. I'm going to have that restless, irritable discontent. The book talks about it. The book takes a real bizarre right turn on page 60 to 63. It's been up to there talking about the physical allergy, the mental obsession, spiritual malady. You know, when we straighten out spiritually, we straighten out mentally and physically and stuff like that. And I wasn't hearing this stuff in the meetings, but there's a weird place right there where all of a sudden, now it's got me hooked, right? It's got me admitting that I'm an alcoholic. It's got me interested in a spiritual solution. Am I even willing to believe? Because the first thing that if I really pound step one into a guy, he knows that he's beyond human aid. That's the way the book rolls it out. It talks about the powerlessness, the loss of choice and control, the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And it says when this sort of thinking is fully established in a person with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid. Right? What does that mean, beyond human aid? That means I can't fix me. Katie can't fix me. My sponsor can't fix me. 90 meetings in 90 days won't fix me. A counselor, a therapist, nope, you know, no human power is going to be able to fix me. Well, if I'm completely screwed, which is the bottom line of step one, you know, sorry, pal, you're SOL, then, and no human power can, see how they kind of cleverly roll out the whole higher power thing there? Is by saying, if you're beyond human aid, well, now all of a sudden, God starts looking kind of interesting, or whatever you want to call him. I mean, because if I can handle it, why would I need your higher power business? You know, and the only reason we talk about a higher power in here, it's not like we get a new toaster for signing a guy up for Sunday school or something. You know, I mean, the reason we talk about a higher power in here is because it's the only thing we've ever seen that works, right? I mean, before this book came out, they had a 2% success rate with drunks like us. Out of 100 of us that would come in the door, 2 of us would make it. And the other 98% would either go to the prison or the mental asylum. You could go to the mental asylum for life back then for chronic inebriation, and or we'd die. And if you've seen people die of this disease, it ain't pretty. You know, that bitter end doesn't always come real fast, you know. Well, what happened for me, though, was I was living a life that was still completely self-centered, but I was involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to AA barbecues, I went to AA dances, I dated AA women, I worked with AA guys, I had AA roommates, I was just in fellowship up to my ears. But I had started backing away from the program, and I had missed the whole piece on selfishness, right? It's strange. I mean, Chuck used to tell a story about a guy, he would talk about the importance of really finding out what the problem was. And he used to tell a story about a guy that had been scared of dogs his whole life. And so in inventory, he started looking back to see where this came from. And when he was a kid, he realized that one of the neighborhood dogs had bit him one day. So ever since, you know, so that's why he'd been scared of dogs his whole life. But then as he looked back a little further, he saw where he remembered that he'd been chasing one of the neighborhood girls across the yard when the dog came out and bit him. And he said, all my life I've been running from dogs and chasing women, and dogs never were my problem, you know. Well, that's, I don't know if you can relate to that, but that's kind of what I've been doing with alcoholism. You know, when you get over there on page 62, there's this huge shift that I completely missed. And for those of you that this is redundant to, God bless you and rock on. You know, but if there's anybody, I don't think I'm the only person that this has happened to. And I want to tell you a little bit about the spiritual awakening I had well into sobriety. When a lot of this started coming around for me, I was sober a good amount of time. But what happened was, there may be people in the room that are sitting in a place where you're going, you know, I still go to some meetings. I don't really read my big book much. I'm not sponsoring anybody. I'm not going out to any treatment center. I'm way too busy. I got kids and shit, you know. Excuse me. I got kids, you know, and stuff. I still go to the meeting occasionally. But I'm, you know, and I'm not thinking about drinking, right? You know, you take that guy that's in that position and you let him go to the dentist or blow a knee out in a motorcycle crash or something like that. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen that guy, you hand him a bottle of Vicodin, and 2 weeks later he's going, what the hell just happened? You know, because I'm walking around. What happens is, over a period of time, God's will starts dropping down like this. As far as God consciousness, it's out the window. You know, it's all me, and it's me, and it's me, and it's me. And, you know, step out of the way. Yeah, I got faith in God. But, I mean, you know, there's a thing in here where it says, and it's in the 12 and 12, where it says we can have faith and still keep God out of our lives. What that means is I get in this place where I'm running the deal, you know, and I go, oh, yeah, man, I got faith in God. Sure, absolutely. Man, God is awesome, you know, but I mean, I don't need him for this, but, you know, but I mean, if I come across something really big, I mean, I'm bringing God right in, you know, but I mean, so I'm rolling along with no God consciousness. It doesn't even come into play in any of my decisions. And what happens is God's will drops down like this, self-will comes up like this, and I don't even know what's happening, right? You know, and so next thing you know, traffic's pissing me off, Katie's pissing me off, my kids are pissing me off, the business, everything, and, you know, and I can't, you know, there's a thing on where it says, isn't he operating under the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from this world if he only manages well? And that's exactly what I was doing. I was managing my backside off, but I couldn't quite get it going, you know. And there's that thing on 62 where it says, though he's sure he is somewhat at fault, he is sure other people are more to blame. Anybody experienced that? You know, I mean, it says on there, here's the thing, when I was talking about not really knowing what the problem is, right here on page 62, right here on 60, it says, my first time through the steps, I'd done a third step prayer on my knees, I did a fourth step, I did six and seven, didn't mean much to me, but, you know, we did them, and then eight and nine, I thought, well, I'll do those, then I'll feel better about me, and then I won't have to drink all the time. Four and five was so I'd feel better about me, you know, and then I won't have to drink. It's total BS. I mean, it's not at all. Some of the crap you hear in AA meetings, my favorite pet peeve is, you know, sometimes I like to think about the newcomer. I like to think so much about what it's like, you know, when they say the chanting, God almighty, the chanting drives me out of my mind. You know, I mean, I think about this guy coming in, he's been shooting heroin and drinking whiskey for 14 years, and he comes in and we're chanting like a bunch of kids at summer camp, you know, I mean, you know, he's going, Jesus, I want to stop, but I don't know about all this, you know, I mean, you know, but the guy comes in and he hears something two or three times, and he starts thinking, well, it must be AA, right? I mean, I heard it in an AA meeting, and they keep saying, you know, one of the ones that always gets me is this is a selfish program, right? How many times have you heard that? Well, you know, this is a selfish program. Well, you hear it a few times, you start thinking, I heard it in AA, you know, they said it was a selfish program. It must, total bullshit. It's not in the meeting. It's not in the book anywhere. In fact, the book is full of stuff where it says, though at the time we're getting our lives in order, that is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellows. And then, you know, over here on page 14, it says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Just a couple more. 94. It says, suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Does that sound like a selfish program? You know, I mean, it's just full of that stuff. And what I had done was I had missed that selfishness piece. There's a line there on page 60 when we're going into step 3 where it says, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life, not just an alcoholic life, any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, right? That line didn't touch me. I don't know about anybody else, but the first time I went through the steps, that line, not only was I not convinced that my life run on self-will couldn't be a success, I didn't even give it a thought, you know? I mean, you know, think about it in the third step prayer where it goes, relieve me of the bondage of self, whatever, you know, I mean, what does that mean? You know, I mean, you know, I'm just down on my knees. I'm nervous as hell. I got a grown man, and we're down on our knees together. And, you know, I mean, is anybody looking? And you know, but going back through it, what happened for me? Oh boy, we got 8 minutes. I was in a plane crash in 2003. I chartered a plane out on Eastern Long Island to go back into Manhattan. I was in that place where I wasn't really doing the deal, but I was, you know, I've been sober a good while. We crashed into the water at night. I mean, it's no Earl Hightower story, but it was pretty damn dramatic, you know. And I mean, we crashed into the water at night and had to escape from an underwater plane that the doors wouldn't open on. And what happened was, and that's the shortest version I can tell you of the story, but what happened was, I didn't understand at the time, but it was the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me because I knew that there was dishonesty in my life. I knew that there was some stuff that I wasn't doing that didn't quite jive with the program. And what I'd started doing was, you don't want to get down on your knees and say, God, you take care of my whole life. Well, I mean, everything but this, you know, and I'll handle that insurance deal, you know, but everything else, God, you know, you can't. Well, so what happens for a guy like me is you just quit getting down on your knees. And I'd been in that place for a while where I was totally on self-will. I'm not checking in with God because I had hit the wall with self-will early in my program where I didn't feel like I was getting a good deal, and I went the wrong way. I went more into self-will. I thought, to hell with this AA thing. I tried it your way, and I'm not getting what I wanted, and I started running more on self-will. Well, I hit the wall with that, and what happened as a result of that, I can't believe I got 6 minutes to get this in. What happened as a result of that, I came out of that deal, and I remember going to my sponsor and going, you know, I'm so self-centered that I can't even have a conversation with somebody. I mean, I have to force myself to say, how's the wife? You know, how are the kids? You know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, you know what I mean? Because I want to talk about me, you know, and I mean, that's self-centered, you know, and my sponsor says, we're going to go out to the ranch tomorrow and talk to the winos. The reason I tell this story is because it did not sound like a good idea. The idea of going and working with these guys, you're like, no. See, they're going to want to talk about themselves, and I want to talk about me, and you know, but what happened, though, was it was the beginning of the bright spot of my life. You know, I started working with these guys, and there was times where I felt like I was sometimes a step ahead of these guys because I was getting a new understanding of this book. I was really going into the book and really reading it line by line, word by word. I started going to the primary purpose group where we studied the book sentence by sentence and then go back through it. And it brings about a depth of this book that I never knew was there. That book is 500 feet deep, and I'd never stuck a toe in it. You know, I mean, I just, you know, tried to pick up what my understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous in the meetings. When I started going into the book, I started hanging out with other big book thumpers, and how can we grow in understanding and effectiveness? We're on the phone with each other every day going, okay, now what are you going to do when a guy says this? Well, you know, what I usually say is this and that. You know, I pull into this part of the book, and I go to this part of the book, and we're, you know, and what I'm trying to get to is that I caught fire with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason that that's important is because if you'd have come to me, if you're sitting in the room tonight and you've been around a while, now, you know, for the new guys, welcome, I love you, I'm glad you're here. I think there's plenty of message of the hope of recovery for the new guy in the rooms. But if you're sitting in the rooms and you've been here a little while, you've been here 2 years, 3 years, and you're not feeling what you hear people talking about, what I'm telling you is it's still available. It's available as a result of the work right out of the book of this program. And I never knew that. If you'd have come to me when I had 17 years and said, Charlie, what is going to change your life and what's going to set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you you're full of crap, because I've been in AA for a while. I know what that does for me. I've experienced AA, but, you know, I got merit badges in this program. I've been around a while. I've sponsored guys. You know, I mean, I've done the deal. I've made the damn coffee, you know. But what happened was I got into this work in a whole other level, and I got with guys. You know, on page 164 in our book, it says, but obviously you cannot transmit something that you haven't got. You know, what they're saying is, if I've been just going to meetings and a guy comes up to me and says, hey, man, would you sponsor me? What the hell am I going to tell him? You know, am I going to just say, go to 90 meetings in 90 days and put the plug in the jug and don't drink no matter what, you know, and stuff? I might as well say, just say no, you know. I mean, because page 24 in our book tells me that I drink no matter what. You know, that I'm going to come to the point where I have no mental defense against the first drink. I got into this stuff. We started doing the primary purpose group. Watching people catch fire with this program is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I mean, all I'm telling you is that I'm more into the big book than I've ever been in my life. I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. I'm happier than I ever would have thought was possible as a result of being involved, deeply involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're sitting in the room and you're not experiencing what you hear people talking about up here, get into the book. Get with somebody that's done the work out of the book. To me, it's a fair question to go to a sponsor and say, just like it says in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. To me, it's a fair question when you're shopping for a sponsor to go, hey, man, have you had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? And if the guy goes, hey, rock on, pal, I'm going to go get some coffee, you know? I mean, the guy I'm looking for is going to go, absolutely. Oh, absolutely, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I can show you exactly what I did, because it all came right out of this book. That's what I'm talking about. That's, you know, and that's what we've been doing. And I got a network of big book thumper guys, you know, that, you know, the best day I've ever been involved with takes place at my kitchen table on Thursday nights. We call it the Common Solution Meeting. And it's my sponsor, Mark H., me, and all the guys that I sponsor. And we meet on Thursday. And the reason we call it Common Solution is because we're going for one voice, one message. You know, whether you talk to me or Jamie or Troy or any of the guys, you should be getting the same message right out of this book. You know, not any of my opinion. My opinion is suspect. But when I come out of this book, which I do a lot, it's just the best. Sponsoring guys, I can't even tell you. I mean, I got a guy. There's a lot of stories about the sponsors, but I always talk about Jamie, because I got this cat that I've been. When this guy came up to ask me to sponsor him, I was not excited. You know, I'm out at the treatment center. I've been coming for a while, you know, and my talk's getting better, and I'm feeling more, you know, like I really got something to offer now. I'm starting to understand the process on a deeper and deeper level, and really feel like, and here comes this guy, and he's got dreadlocks out to here, and a ring in his nose, and the ink all over him, and hey, what's up, this guy, you know, an hour and a half later, we were down on our knees under a tree there at the Austin Recovery Center doing a third step prayer together, and he really knew what it meant to be an alcoholic. He knew what it was like to have an interest in a spiritual program, and he knew the deal that we were making in step three. It wasn't some vague deal. He knew that we were going to quit playing God, and that if, you know, it says being all powerful, he'll provide what I need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. That's all I got to do, right? So I get down with Jamie. The reason I like to tell the story is because I'm going to end with this. One day I was talking to Jamie, and I said, you know, dude, I got to tell you, as your sponsor, I will seldom ever tell you what to do. I mean, we'll talk about spiritual principles. We'll talk about the big book. I'll refer you to places in the book, and then you'll make the decision yourself based on what you want to do. I mean, I'm rarely going to tell you what to do. Having said that, though, if there ever comes a day where you think about taking that ring out of your nose, you don't have to call me on that one. You know, but the guy is on fire. I mean, he is such a soldier for this program. And, I mean, you just to watch that guy catch fire has just been the joy of my life. And I almost missed it. I could have drank at any time during that period, around 15, 17 years, and I would have thought I knew what AA had to offer me. And it's awesome. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I'm out of time. Both you and this is from page 100 of our big book. Both you and the new man must walk day by day on the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things that came to us when we placed ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thanks for having me tonight. I really enjoyed it.